You had something to say?
I guess the summit was my resistance to wake up. I had a little problem with understanding. I guess I never thought self-interest in the way you're presenting it was in itself a bad thing. And I never acquainted it with selfishness. I mean, equated it.
Hey, bad comes from you. I didn't say it's bad.
Well,
I said it's self-interest.
Asking,
you added bad.
Because self-interest, to me, it seems like it comes right out of our instinct of self-preservation, which is our, I think, our deepest and first. So that, how could we even want to opt for selflessness that would be almost like opting for non-being?
Wonderful. You're just saying we cannot be selfless. Are you saying that?
Well, to me, it would seem like it would be the same thing as asking for non-being.
Whatever it is. Look, all I'm saying is, stop feeling bad. We're all the same. It's wonderful. Somebody had a terribly beautiful thing to say about Jesus. So I promised I wouldn't get into that, but it's too tempting to get into it here. Yeah, it's very tempting. He said, the lovely thing about Jesus, and this guy wasn't an official Christian, he said, the lovely thing about Jesus was that he was so much at home with sinners because he understood that he wasn't one bit better than they were. We differ from others, from criminals, only in what we do or what we don't do, but not in what we are. The only difference between Jesus, I assume, and those sinners was that he was awake. They weren't. You want to glory in that? Look at me. I won the lottery. I'm so proud to accept this prize. It's really a prize for not for me, but for my nation and my society. Does anybody talk like this when he wins the lottery? He was lucky. He won the lottery. First prize. Anything to be proud of in that? I woke up. I got enlightened. And you gradually learn there's nothing you could do with your good luck, good fortune. And if you did anything towards being enlightened, now listen to this. Almost every one of you really wants to wake up. In the interest of whom? Aha! You want to glory in that? Look at me. I really worked for myself. What's there to glory about? Can you see how utterly stupid it is to be vain about your good deeds? The Pharisee isn't an evil man. He's a stupid man. He's stupid. He's not evil. He's stupid. Didn't stop to think. Like somebody who said, I dare not stop to think, because if I did, I wouldn't know how to get started again. Anyone can be expected to be selfish and to seek their own self-interest, whether in coarse or in refined ways. So there's nothing to be disappointed about. And there's nothing to be disillusioned about. If you had been in touch with reality all along, you would never have been disappointed. But you chose to paint people in glowing colors. You chose not to see through human beings because you chose not to see through yourself. And so you're paying the price now. Before you discuss this, let me tell you a story which I remember just now. Somebody said, what is enlightenment like? What is awakening like? It's like the tramp in London who was settling in for the night. He'd barely been able to eat a crust of bread. Then he gets onto this embankment on the River Thames and there's a slight drizzle. So he huddles in his old tattered cloak. And as he's about to sleep, what do you know? A Rolls Royce rolls up, chauffeur driven, And out of that car steps a gorgeously beautiful young lady who says, "My poor man, are you planning to spend the night here on this embankment?" And the poor man says, "Yes." She says, "I won't have it. You're coming to my house and you're going to spend a comfortable night and you're going to get a good dinner." So she insists on his getting into the car. They ride out of London, get into a place where she has a sprawling mansion, large grounds. They get in, they're ushered in by the butler, and she hands this man over to the butler and says, "James, make sure he's put in the servants' quarters and treated well," which is what James does. And when the young lady is about to go to bed, she'd undressed and was going to bed, she suddenly remembered her guest for the night, so she slips something on and goes over to the servants' quarters and pads along the corridor and sees a little chink of light where the man was apparently put up. So he hadn't gone to sleep. She taps lightly at the door and opens it and finds the man awake. And she says, "What's the trouble, my good man? Did you not get a good meal?" He said, "Never had a better meal in my life, lady." "Are you warm enough?" He says, "Yes, lovely warm bed." She says, "Maybe you need a little company, huh? Why don't you move over a bit?" And she comes close to him. He moves over and falls right into the Thames. Ah, you didn't expect that one. Enlightenment. Enlightenment. Wake up. You really did expect that one, huh? See how good you are? Wake up when you're ready to exchange your illusions for reality. When you're ready to exchange your dreams for facts. Cold awakening. But that's where you find it all. That's where life finally becomes meaningful. Life becomes beautiful. The famous story, I don't remember where I read it, of Ramirez, who's old and is living up there in his castle on top of a hill, and he looks out the window. He's in bed, really, and paralyzed, looking out the window, and he sees his enemy, old as he himself is, leaning on a cane, climbing up the hill, slowly, painfully. Takes him about 2.5 hours to get up, and there's nothing Ramirez can do because the servants have the day off. And his enemy walks in, opens the door, comes straight to the bedroom, puts his hand inside his cloak pocket and pulls out a gun. And he says, "At last, Ramirez, we're going to settle scores." And Ramirez tries his level best to talk him out of it. He says, "Come on, Borges, you can't do that. You know, I am no longer the man who ill-treated that youngster years ago, and you're no longer that youngster. Come off it." "Oh no, your sweet words aren't going to get me off this divine mission of mine. It's revenge I want," says Borges, "and there's nothing you can do about it." And Ramirez says, "There is." "Oh, is there? What?" "I can wake up." And he did. He woke up. That's what enlightenment is like. "There's nothing you can do about it, isn't there?" "Of course there is." "What?" "I can wake up." All of a sudden, life is no longer the nightmare that it has seemed. Wake up. Somebody came to me with a question. What do you think the question was?
What was the question?
"Are you enlightened?" says this question. What do you think the answer was? What does it matter? You want a better answer? How would I know?
Because I don't care.
How would you know? And what does it matter? You know something? If you want it too badly, you're in big trouble. You know something else? If I were enlightened, and you listened to me because I was enlightened, you're in big trouble. You ready to be brainwashed by someone who's enlightened? You could be brainwashed by anybody, you know. So does it really matter? No, it doesn't. Where you're concerned, what does it matter whether someone's enlightened or not? But see, we want to lean on someone, don't we? We want to lean on somebody who we think or we judge has arrived. We love to hear that people have arrived. It gives us hope, doesn't it? What do you want hope for? Isn't that another form of desire? You want to hope for something better than what you have right now, don't you? Or else you wouldn't be hoping. But then you forgot that you've got it all right now and you don't know it. Why not concentrate on now instead of hoping for better times in the future? Why not understand the now instead of forgetting it and hoping for the future? Isn't that another trap? The only place someone can be of help to you is in challenging your ideas. Maybe, if you're ready to listen and you're ready to be challenged. But there's one thing, the most important of all, and I haven't mentioned it as yet, that you could do when no one can help you. What's this most important thing of all? It's called self-observation. No one can help you there. No one can give you a method. No one can show you a technique. Because the moment you pick up a technique, you're programmed again. Self-observation, watching yourself, which is not the same as self-absorption. Self-absorption is self-preoccupation. You're concerned about yourself. You're worried about yourself. I'm talking about self-observation. What's that? It means to watch everything as far as possible in you and around you, as if it were happening to someone else. To watch everything in you and around you as if it were happening to someone else. What does that last sentence mean? It means that you do not personalize what is happening to you. It means you look at it as if you have no connection with it whatsoever. The reason you suffer from your depressions and your anxieties is that you identify with them. You're saying, I am depressed, and that is false. You are not depressed. If you want to be accurate, you might say, I is experiencing a depression right now. But you could hardly define yourself with the verb to be and say, I am depressed. You are not your depression. But by a strange kind of trick of the mind, by a strange kind of illusion, you have deluded yourself into thinking, though you're not aware of it, that you are your depression, that you are your anxiety, that you are your joy and the thrills that you have. I am delighted. You certainly are not delighted. Delight is in you right now. But hang around. It'll change. Won't last. Never lasts. Keeps changing. It's always changing. Clouds come and clouds go. Some of them are black. Some of them are white. Some of them are large. Others are small. And if we want to follow the analogy, this isn't philosophy now. This is just an analogy. You are the sky. You're observing them all. You're a passive, detached observer. My, that's shocking. Particularly in the Western culture. This is shocking. Passive. You're not interfering. Don't interfere. Don't fix anything. Watch. Observe. The trouble with people is they're busy fixing things they don't even understand. We're always fixing things, aren't we? Never strikes us that things don't need to be fixed. They really don't. This is the great illumination. They need to be understood. If you understood them, they'd change. They really would, if you understood them. You want to change the world? How about beginning with yourself? How about changing yourself? How about being transformed yourself first? How do you achieve that? Through observation, through understanding. With no interference, with no judgment, because what you judge, you cannot understand. My, that's a tall order, isn't it? He's a communist. Understanding has stopped at that minute. You slapped a label on him. She's a capitalist. Understanding has stopped as of that minute. You slapped a label on her. And if the label carries undertones of approval or disapproval, even worse. How are you going to understand what you disapprove of? Or what you approve of, for that matter. Sounds like a new world, doesn't it? Well, ready to hear something new? No judgment. No comment. No attitude. One observes. One studies. One watches. Not even with the desire to change what is. Example, a dog trainer who's attempting to understand a dog so that he can train the dog to perform certain tricks. The scientist who observes the behavior of ants with no further end in view. He just wants to study ants and to learn as much as possible about them, and he has no further aim. He's not attempting to train them or to get anything out of them. He's interested in ants. He wants to learn as much as he can about them. That's the attitude. The day you attain that, you will experience a miracle. You will change. Effortlessly, correctly. Change will happen. You will not bring it about. As the light of awareness settles upon your darkness, whatever is evil will disappear. Whatever is good will be fostered. You will have to experience that for yourself. But this calls for a disciplined mind. And when I say disciplined, I'm not talking about effort. I'm talking about something else. Have you ever studied an athlete whose whole life is athletics? What a disciplined life he or she leads. And look at that river as it moves towards the sea. It creates its own banks, does it not, to contain it. And when there's something within you that moves in this direction, it creates its own discipline. The moment you get bitten by the bug of awareness, oh, that's so delightful. The most delightful thing in the world, the most important and the most delightful. Because there's nothing so important in the world as coming awake, nothing. And there's nothing so delightful as being aware. Would you rather live in darkness? Would you rather act and not be aware of your actions? Talk and not be aware of your words? Would you rather listen to people and not be aware of what you're hearing? Or see things and not be aware of what you're looking at? The great Socrates, who said, "The unaware life is not worth living." But a self-evident truth. But most people don't live aware lives. They're living mechanical lives. Mechanical thoughts, generally somebody else's. Mechanical emotions. Mechanical action. Mechanical reactions. Want to see how mechanical you are? My, that's a lovely shirt you're wearing. I feel up. For a shirt, for heaven's sake. You feel proud of yourself when you observe that? People come over to my center there in India and they say, "What a lovely place your center is situated in. These lovely trees," for which I'm not responsible at all, "and this lovely climate, and already I'm feeling good," till I catch myself feeling good. Say, "Hey, could you imagine anything more stupid than that? I'm not responsible for those trees. I wasn't even responsible for choosing the location. I didn't order the weather. It happened. But it's mine. Me got in there, and I'm feeling good. And I'm feeling good about my culture and my nation." How stupid can you get? I mean that. And they're saying, "You know, your great Indian culture that has produced all these mystics." I didn't produce them. I'm not responsible for it. And you know, "Oh, that country of yours, disgusting. Look at the poverty." I'm feeling ashamed. I didn't create it. What's going on? Ever stop to think? You know something? "I think you're very charming. Oh, I feel wonderful. I got a positive stroke." That's what they call it. "I'm okay, you're okay." I'm going to write a book someday which will be entitled, "I'm an ass, you're an ass." I really am. I really am. Yes, most liberating thing in the world. Wonderful. Most liberating thing in the world. Can you imagine that? When you're openly ready to admit you're an ass, it's wonderful. They say, "You're wrong." I say, "What could you expect of an ass?" Disarmed. Everybody disarmed. We're coming to that. We're coming to that. We're coming to that. The final liberation. "I'm an ass, you're an ass." I press a button, you're up. I press another button, you're down. You like that? How many people you know who are unaffected by praise or blame? totally and completely unaffected. That isn't human. Human means you've got to be a little monkey. So everybody can twist your tail and you do whatever they think you ought to be doing. Is that human? You mean you find me charming? You know what that means? It means right now you're in a good mood. That's what it means. Generally, it also means that I fit your shopping list. Every one of us carries a shopping list around, you know. And it's like, you've got to measure up to this. Tall, dark, handsome, according to my tastes. I like the sound of his voice. I'm in love. You're not in love, silly ass. Anytime you're in love, I wonder if I should say this, you're being particularly asinine. You really are. Sit down and watch it. What's happening to you? You're running away from yourself? You want a nice, good escape? Somebody said, thank God for reality and for giving us the means to escape from it. So that's what's going on. We're so mechanical. We're so controlled. And we write books about being controlled and how wonderful it is to be controlled and how necessary to be controlled and how necessary that people would tell you that you're okay so that then you'll have a good okay feeling about yourself, etc., etc., etc. How wonderful it is to be in prison, or as somebody said yesterday so rightly, to be in your cage. You like being in prison? You like being controlled? Because I'll tell you something. If you ever let yourself feel good when they tell you that you're okay, you're preparing yourself to feel bad when they tell you you're not. And secondly, you're going to be a monkey for the rest of your life because you're the whole time going to live up to their expectations. You better watch out what you wear and how you comb your hair and whether your shoes are polished and whether you live up to every D-A-M-N-E-D expectation of theirs. Every one of them. You like that? You call it human? See? See what I mean? This is what you'll discover when you observe yourself. You'll be horrified. Because the fact of the matter is that you're neither okay nor not okay. You really are not. What's okay? What's not okay? You mean you fit the current mood or trend or fashion, so you become okay? Does your okayness depend on that? Does your okayness depend on what people think of you? Jesus Christ must have been pretty not okay, you know, by those standards. So, you're not okay. You're not not okay. You're you. And that, I hope, is going to be the big discovery. At least some of you, if three of you, I think you're about 220 or 30 or whatever, if three or four of you make this discovery during these 4 days we're going to spend together, my, what a wonderful thing! Extraordinary! Unprecedented! You're you. Cut out all the okay stuff and the not okay stuff. Cut out all the judgments and observe. Watch. You'll make great discoveries. Those discoveries will change you. You won't have to make the slightest effort, believe me. Here's another bombshell. Talking about a bombshell. Reminds me about this guy in London after the war. He's sitting with a large parcel on his lap, wrapped in brown paper. Big, heavy object. And the bus conductor says to him, he says, what have you got in your lap there? And the man says, this is an unexploded bomb. We dug it out of the garden. I'm taking it to the police station. He says, is that an unexploded bomb? And the guy says, yes. You don't want to carry that on your lap. Put it under the seat. That's my story for telling what psychology and spirituality, as we generally understand it, does for you. You know, it transfers the bomb from your lap to under your seat. It doesn't really solve your problems. It doesn't. It exchanges your problems for other problems. Has that ever struck you? You had a problem. Now we exchange it for another one. And it's always going to be that way. Till we solve the problem called you, we're going to get nowhere. And so these great mystics and masters in the East will say, who are you? Want to know the most important question in the world? You think it is, who is Jesus Christ? Wrong. You think it is, does God exist? Wrong. You think it is there a life after death? Wrong. You know, it's a funny thing. Nobody seems to be grappling with the problem of, is there a life before death? No one. No one. And my experience has been that it's precisely the ones who don't know what to do with this life who are all bothered about what they're going to do with another life. Really. That's one sign that you're awakened. You don't give a damn what's going to happen in the next life. You're not bothered about it. You don't care. You just don't care. Not interested. Period. Somebody talked about eternal life a little while ago, the gentleman there. You know what eternal life is? Whatever that is. You think it's everlasting life. But your own theologians will tell you that that's crazy. Because everlasting is still within time. It's time perduring forever. You got it all wrong. Eternal means timeless. No time. Whatever that means, because the human mind cannot understand that. The human mind can understand time and can deny time. But what timeless means is beyond our comprehension.
Except we have bits of it, don't we?
And the mystics tell us that it's right now. How's that for good news? It's right now. People get so distressed when I tell them, forget your past. So proud of your past. You're crazy. Remember? I'm an ass, you're an ass. You're crazy. What are you proud of? You're so ashamed of your past. You're crazy. Drop it. But mustn't I weep for my sins? That's past. It's dead. Drop it. Get into now. See your great religious distraction from waking up. Weep for your sins. Repent. Wake up, that's what repent means. Wake up. Understand, understand. Stop all your crying. And so the great masters tell us, the most important question in the world is, who am I? Who am I? What is I? We'll address ourselves to that question this afternoon at 4 o'clock. I'll begin with that, hopefully. I say hopefully because I never know what I'm going to say next, because it all depends on the mood of the group, etc. But that's so important. What is I? What is this thing I call I? What is this thing I call the self? You mean you understood everything else in the world and you didn't understand this? You mean you understood astronomy and black holes? And whatever those other things are, quasars or whatever they call them, you understood that and you picked up computer science and you don't know who you are? My, you're still asleep. You're a sleeping scientist. You mean you understood what Jesus Christ is and you don't know what you are? How do you know that you have understood? Who's this guy? Who's this woman who's doing the understanding? Found that out first? That's the foundation of everything, isn't it? And it's because we haven't understood this that you've got all these stupid religious people who are engaging in all kinds of stupid religious wars, Muslims fighting against Jews, Protestants fighting Catholics, and all the rest of that rubbish. They don't know who they are. Because if they did, there wouldn't be wars. Like the little girl who says to the little boy, "Are you a Presbyterian?" He says, "No, we belong to another abomination." So there it goes. It's, who are you? Who am I? Who am I? Who am I? We'll be dealing with that later, as I said. But what I'd like to stress right now is self-observation. You're listening to me. Are you picking up any other sounds besides the sound of my voice as you listen to me? Are you aware of your reactions as you listen to me? It's extremely important, or else you're going to be brainwashed. Or else you're going to be influenced by forces within you of which you have no awareness at all. And when you're aware of how you're reacting to me, are you simultaneously aware? Now that's postgraduate work, okay? Okay. Are you aware of where it's coming from? Maybe you're not listening to me at all. Maybe your daddy's listening to me. You think that's possible? Of course it is. Again and again in my therapy groups, I come across people who aren't there at all. Their daddy's there. Their mommy's there. They're not there. They never were there. They really weren't. I live now, not I. My daddy lives in me. Really? Well, that's absolutely true. Literally true. Literally true. I could take you apart and say, now this sentence, does it come from daddy, mommy, grandma, grandpa, from whom? Reminds me of grandma and grandpa who are celebrating their wedding anniversary. They're old. It's the 60th anniversary of their wedding. And they go through all the celebrations. And they're tired. And towards the evening, the two of them are sitting alone in a room. And Grandpa says to Grandma, he says, "You know, Grandma, I'm proud of you. I really am." She says, What's that you said, Pa? "You know, I can't hear you. You know I can't hear you without my hearing aid. Would you say that louder?" He says, "I said I'm proud of you." She says, "That's all right. I'm tired of you, too." Okay. Yes. So it's like, who's living in you? It's pretty horrifying when you come to know that. You think you're free. But there probably isn't a gesture, a thought, an emotion, an attitude, a belief in you that isn't coming from someone else. Isn't that horrible? And you don't know it. Talk about a mechanical life that was stamped into you. And you're feeling pretty strongly about certain things, and you think you are feeling strongly about it. But are you really? It's going to take a lot of awareness for you to understand that maybe this thing that you call I is simply an agglomeration of your past experiences and of your conditioning and your programming. You're a human computer. That's painful. In fact, when you're beginning to awake, you experience a good deal of pain. It's painful to see your illusions being shattered and everything that you thought you had built up crumbling. That's painful. That's what repentance is all about. That's what waking up is all about. So now, how about this? How about you're taking a minute, right where you are, where you're sitting now, to be aware of, even as I talk, of what you're feeling in your body. and what's going on in your mind. And what your emotional state is like. How about being aware of that blackboard if your eyes are open? And the color of the walls? How about being aware of my face? And the reaction you have to that face of mine? Because you have one whether you're aware of it or not. And it probably isn't yours. You were conditioned to have that kind of reaction. And how about being aware of some of the things I said? So that isn't awareness now, that's memory, I'm cheating. But still, I'm assuming you're beginners. Think of some of the things you did not like. And think of some of the things you liked. And how you reacted. Does that say anything about you? And let's make a sudden switch now. Be aware of your presence in this room. It's a sudden switch. I'm in this room. It's as if you were outside yourself, looking at yourself, sitting here, as if you're looking at someone else. Do you notice a slightly different feeling? Later we'll ask, who's this person who's doing the looking? I am looking at me. What's I? What's me? But for the time being, it's enough that I would be watching me. And if you're tending to condemn yourself or to approve of yourself, don't stop the condemnation now. Don't stop the judgment. Don't stop the approval. Just watch it. I'm condemning me. I'm disapproving. Or I'm approving. Just look at it. Don't try to fix it. Don't say, oh, we were told not to do this. No, just observe what's going on. As I said to you before, self-observation means watching, observing whatever is going on in you and around you as if it were happening to someone else. Ever hear what happened to the hippopotamus who swallowed a Jewish rabbi, a Protestant minister, and a Catholic priest?
No.
Why, he had an ecumenical movement. That's what happened. Let's continue from where we left off this morning. I'm sure lots of you will have questions. I propose we leave them for a little later. Because once I've spoken about two or three other topics, maybe some of the things you were planning to ask me about will get clarified. So, I suggest that before I take up the next topic, you do the following. Would you write down on a piece of paper any adjectives that you would use to describe yourself? Any adjectives. Businessman, priest, human being, Catholic, Jew, anything. Well, or any labels like businessman, etc.
How about Jerusalem?
Anything. Adjectives or nouns that you would use to describe yourself. You're in for a big surprise. You really are. So write those down. You're really going to enjoy this. Now let's have a few samples. One from each person. Just a few samples, you know. Anyone? What was that?
Prognosticator.
Prognosticator. She planned this one. Okay. Any others?
Fruitful.
Searching pilgrim.
Searching pilgrim. Competent.
Alive.
Alive.
Impatient.
Impatient. Centered.
Flexible.
Flexible.
Sorry.
Lover.
What was that?
Reconciler.
Reconciler.
Lover.
Lover.
Member of the human race.
Member of the human race.
Sure.
Overly structured.
Overly structured. All right. That's a pretty good introduction for what we're going to get into right now. Remember I said to you this morning that you would derive immense profit from self-observation, observing yourself. Remember? As if you were watching another person. Observing everything in you and around you. Now let's take a look at that phenomenon. We're going to get right into whatever you want to call it. Philosophy, mysticism, spirituality, you name it. The name doesn't matter. Here you've got I observing me. Now this is an interesting phenomenon which has never ceased to cause wonder to philosophers, mystics, scientists, psychologists. I can observe me. It would seem that the animals are not able to do this. It would seem that one needs a certain amount of intelligence to be able to do this. Self-consciousness. Now I'm warning you, what I'm going to give you now is not metaphysics. It is not philosophy. It's plain observation. Plain common sense. Maybe we'll come back to the philosophy of it later on. But watch this. When I observe me, I looking at me, remember I told you this morning, many of these great mystics of the East would say, who are you? Who am I? Who is I? They're really referring to that I. Not to the me. And let's suppose that I were to observe me observing me. Have you noticed this has become me now? Who's this guy? Search for the I. That's what they're saying. Who's I? And no matter how far back you go, you're always going to have to search for I. What is I? Who is I? Ever thought of that? We've been given all kinds of answers, or we've taken all kinds of answers for granted, but never stopped probably to analyze or to find out for ourselves who I is or what I is. As a matter of fact, some of these mystics will tell you that we first begin with things, with awareness of things. Then we move on to awareness of thoughts. Me. And finally, to awareness of the thinker. Things, thoughts, thinker. What we're really searching for is the thinker. Can the thinker know himself? Can I know what I is? Some of these mystics reply, can the knife cut itself? Can the tooth bite itself? Can the eye, E-Y-E, see itself? Can the eye know itself? But this we will have to leave for later. I am concerned with something infinitely more practical right now, and that is with deciding what the I is not. And I'll go as slowly as possible because it's important that you follow every step here, because the consequences are devastating. Terrific or terrifying, depending on your point of view. You've got the seed of liberation here. Now listen to this. Am I my thought? Is I the thoughts that I am thinking? No. Thoughts come and go. I am not my thoughts. Is that clear?
Yes.
How about my body? Am I my body? They tell us that the cells of our body keep getting changed and renewed, millions of them every minute, so that at the end of about 7 years, you don't have a single living cell in your body which was there 7 years previously. They're always changing. Cells come and go. Cells arise and die. I seems to persist. So, am I my body? Evidently, no. I is something other and more than the body. You might say the body is part of I, but it's a changing part. It keeps moving. It keeps changing. We have the same name for it, but it's constantly changing. Just as we have the same name for Niagara Falls. But Niagara Falls is constituted by the water, which is constantly changing. Same name for an ever-changing reality. I seems to continue, even though the body cells are changing. How about my name? Is I my name? Evidently not, because I could change my name. I don't change the I when I change my name. How about my career? How about my beliefs? I am a Catholic. I am a Jew. Is that an essential part of I when I move from one religion to another? Has I changed? And let's suppose I get back to my original religion. Has I changed? Do I have a new I? Or is it the same I that has changed? In other words, is my name an essential part of me, of the I? Is my religion an essential part of the I? Remember I told you this morning about the little boy who says to the little girl, are you a Presbyterian, remember? Somebody told me one about someone in Belfast. Paddy was walking down the streets, and he finds there's a gun there at the back of his head, pressing against the back of his head, and a voice says, are you Catholic or Protestant? Well, Paddy had to do some pretty fast thinking. He said, I'm a Jew. and he hears the voice say, "I've got to be the luckiest Arab in the whole of Belfast." Isn't it interesting how important labels are for us? They're so important. I am a Democrat. I am a Republican. Are you really now? You mean when you switch parties, do you have a new eye? Or is it the same old eye with new political convictions? Remember hearing about the guy who says to his friend, he says, "Hey, Tom, are you planning to vote Democrat in the next elections?" He says, "No, I'm planning," or rather, "Are you planning to vote Republican?" The guy says, "No, I'm planning to vote Democrat." "Why?" "Because my father was a Democrat, my grandfather was a Democrat, my great-grandfather was a Democrat, so I'm voting Democrat." And the other guy says, "That's crazy logic, Paddy. I mean, now let's put it this way. If your father was a horse thief, and your grandfather was a horse thief, and your great-grandfather was a horse thief, what would you be?" He said, "Well, then I'd be a Republican." So labels. Labels, labels, labels. So where does that get you? And we spend so much of our lives, don't we, reacting to labels, our own and others, identifying the label with the eye. Talking about Catholics and Protestants, you hear the one about the guy who comes in and says, "Father, I want to say a mass for my dog." Father's indignant, he's outraged. "What do you mean say a mass for your dog?" He says, "You know my dog, my pet dog, I love that dog, I'd like you to offer a mass for him." Father says, "We don't offer masses for dogs, for animals here. You may try the denomination lower down the street. Ask them, they might have a service for you." And the guy, as he's moving away, he says, "Too bad, I really love that dog. I was planning to offer $1 million in stipend for that mass." Father says, "Wait a minute, you never told me your dog was Catholic." When you're caught up in labels, what value do these labels have when applied to I? That's an interesting question. I'll invite you to think about it later, to discuss it. Could we say that I is none of the labels that we attach to it? That these labels belong to me? That what is constantly changing is me. Does the observer ever change? Why bother? The fact is that no matter what labels you can think of, except perhaps human being, you apply them to me. I is none of these things. So when you step out of yourself and observe me, when you step out of yourself and no longer observe, and sorry, and no longer identify with me, you learn all kinds of interesting things. For instance, suffering. Suffering exists in me and when you identify with me. Anytime you identify, anytime I identifies with anything or person outside of itself, or it identifies with me, suffering begins. Now comes fear. Now comes desire. Now comes a threat. The I begins to feel threatened. When I does not identify with money or name or nationality or persons or friends or any quality, the I is not threatened. Can be very active, as I will show you later on, but it isn't threatened. Everybody think of a time, or think of some suffering that you have right now. Anything that's causing you pain, or worry, or anxiety. Think of that. First, can you pick up the desire under that suffering? There's something you desire very keenly, or you wouldn't be suffering. What is it? Second, that isn't just an ordinary desire, that's a craving. Worse, there's an identification there. You have somehow said to yourself, the well-being of I, almost the existence of I, is tied up with this desire. How true is it that all suffering is caused by my identifying myself with something, whether that something is within me or outside of me? And when it is outside of me, whether it is a thing or a person. Talk about it for a couple of minutes, then let's see if we can get some reactions from you. Okay. How about some reactions? Yes.
Well, I want to share with you something wonderful that happened to me. I saw your movie, and I was at work shortly after that, and I was really having trouble with three people. And I said, all right, just like I learned in the movie, I'm going to come outside myself. And for a couple hours, I just got all my feelings together about how bad I felt about these three people. And I said, well, I really hate those people. I mean, I was honest. I got it all together. And I said, well, Jesus, now what can you do about that? And a little while later, I started to cry because I realized that Jesus died for those people, and they couldn't help how they were. And that afternoon, I had to go in the office, and I spoke to those people, and I told them why I was right and what my problem was, and they agreed with me. Because I wasn't mad at them, and I didn't hate them anymore.
Okay, that's wonderful. We'll go a little deeper into that later, shall we?
Okay.
About the negative feelings we have towards others. Anytime you have a negative feeling towards anyone, you're living in an illusion. There's something seriously wrong with you, as you discovered. You're not seeing reality. Something inside of you has to change. But what do we generally do when we have a negative feeling? We're saying, he is to blame, she is to blame, she's got to change. Oh, no, 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 no. The world's all right. The one who has to change is you. But we'll have much more to say about that later. Any other reaction? Yes.
When they work at institutions, I've tried to get some kind of an example. What you meant when you said that if I identified any quality in me at the beginning. And we had a staff meeting, and someone said, the cool thing, normally the dietitian will go into order. So my question is, does that relate to what you're saying? In other words, if you didn't take it personally, who would change?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You know, she's identified with this, and she's saying, anyone who attacks the food is attacking me. I feel threatened. But I is never threatened. It's only me that is threatened. Yes?
Question, baby. So, this pain is not new to you. I have one problem. Supposing that you're witnessing some out of bounds injustice or something that is obviously an objective to be wrong. Now, would it not be a proper reaction to say this cannot be happening, or to be somehow want to involve yourself in correcting this wrong? It may not be simply that I feel bad about the situation, but the situation is objectively wrong. Someone's injuring a child with abuse going on, etc. How about that kind of thing?
Now, did you assume that I was saying that you wouldn't do anything? I said, you wouldn't have negative feelings, as a result of which you'd be much more effective. Because when the negative feelings come in, you go blind. Me steps into the picture. And everything gets fouled up. And frequently, we had a problem on our hand before, now we have two problems. But that's a very good question, because I'll have to come back to that again. Don't assume, I'm glad you brought that out, because lots of people might assume, that not having negative feelings of anger and resentment and hate would mean that you do nothing about a situation. Oh no, oh no. You're not affected emotionally, but you are actionally, if that makes any sense. You spring into action. You become very sensitive to things and people around you. What kills the sensitivity is this. What many people would call the conditioned self. When you identify with me, there's too much of you in it for you to see things objectively, to see things detachedly. And it's very important that when you swing into action, you be able to see things detachedly. But when negative emotions get in, you can no longer do that. So that was a very good question. Yes. You had a question, John.
I was wondering if there's an area before something becomes an attachment, before it becomes identification, like a friend dies. It seems to me that it's human to feel something about that, a sadness. But it becomes identification when it gets in the way of my becoming less free. But it seems there ought to be some type of reaction to my friend's death.
All right. It seems that there ought to be some kind of reaction to my friend's death. Self-pity? What would you be grieving about? Think about this, everybody. What are you grieving about? What I'm saying is going to sound terrible. I told you, I'm coming from another world. Personal loss, right? Feeling sorry for me? All right. You mean you're feeling sorry for other people who are feeling sorry for themselves?
I don't know if they're feeling sorry.
Or they're not feeling sorry for themselves. Then what would I be feeling sorry for? What we call grief. Do we ever feel grief when we lose something that we have allowed to be free, that we have never attempted to possess, and we have never allowed ourselves to be attached to? Meaning. What does it mean to be attached? Meaning, I made my happiness depend on this thing or this person, at least to some extent. We're so accustomed to this that to hear the opposite sounds inhuman. doesn't it?
Yes.